Hello there, Winnie. Now then, listeners can't see, but this is the first time, I think, when I've not seen you in your clericals. You're looking very relaxed. You've got a lovely bead necklace on. What's going on, Winnie?
Well, I'm getting on a plane as soon as we finish this, but I'm in Durham, North Carolina, at this amazing local bed and breakfast after having done the Pauli Murray service at St. Titus, which is near Pauli Murray's childhood home. So I am in the glow of a remarkable evening.
That is amazing. Well, I bet you were amazing at that. Now then, Winnie, I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. Another one of your friends is with us. Tell me who we're going to be meeting today.
I'm so excited about this. So Lanicia Rouse Tinsley is a remarkable visual artist. You can see her work in galleries in New York, in Houston, and all over our country. She spent some time in Leeds, so you two will have to check in on that as a Methodist
Leeds?
Minister.
Yeah, what? Yeah.
I hear you know something about that. And she's someone who has a background in ministry, but then it has been is known as an artist, a wonderful visual artist, and is just a creative, beautiful soul who is does kind of collage and mixed media, and also is a model. You should get her to talk about that. Anyway, you're gonna love her. Lanicia, how great to see you. You look wonderful. Lanicia, I'm so excited that you get to meet today. Azariah is an Anglican priest in Manchester, but I would say also an artist and writer. And I'm sure you all can talk about that. So I'm so excited to introduce the two of you to each other.
Oh, so good to be here, and hello. I've heard so much about you as well. I'm glad to be in this conversation.
It's such a joy to meet you, and little bits of research I've been doing, seeing incredible things of how you've taken what you've been offered and created and recreated new things. Now, one of the things that we often ask our guests is, how would they describe the term home?
It's a beautiful question. Home for me is a place where there is love and space for me to fully show up as myself. And so that can be like the sanctity of like these four walls or the walls that make up our home. But often when I speak of home, I'm referring to my sister, to Cleve, my partner, those friendships and relationships where love is deep and runs deep both ways, and we can all fully show up as ourselves and a space of vulnerability and of life. Yeah, when I think of home, I think of that. And I also think about the grounds of the South that I'm starting to reckon with a bit, being back in the Southeast. I grew up in South Carolina. And so in the deep heart of the USA South, and yeah, I think about fireflies and beautiful trees that I have a complicated relationship with. I think of just the landscape, the dirt, the food, all those comforts and the beauty that lies there, even in the midst of the dirt that also holds the story and the blood of years, hundreds of years. So, yeah, that's home for me, yeah.
This is probably an insider question a little bit, but you were in Houston before you moved to Richmond, and I'm from Dallas. I'm in Durham today, but I also moved to Atlanta recently. Did Texas feel the same for you, or is there something different? How did you experience Texas?
Yeah, so we are splitting time now between the two states, and Texas, you know, it didn't quite feel like the Southeast to me. Texas has its own like identity and self-understanding and fabric that is somewhat different. The diversity of Houston, especially, that I bumped up against, the international kind of community that's there was different than my experience growing up in the Southeast, in South Carolina. But, you know, I've only lived in the South apart from a year in Leeds. And so I don't know if some of what I'm naming is unique to the South, or if I lived in, you know, New York, I would feel that same kind of communal aspects. I don't know. I've traveled a lot, and I'm comparing it to some of the differences that I've experienced on my travels. But I've always lived in this place, so...
So, wait a minute. if I heard correctly, you spoke about South Carolina, Leeds, Texas. Wait a minute. Leeds? Now, I was born and raised in Leeds.
Oh, my God.
You know, on the playground was where I spent most of my days, chilling out, cooling, relaxing.
Yes. I lived in Armley, Leeds. I was pastoring in the British Methodist Church for a year.
That is incredible. How on earth did that come about? And what was that
like?
Yeah,
so...
And how come you're not still in the UK? Because Leeds is the centre of the universe.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. I ask myself that often. How am I still not there? But no, so a very kind of logistical way, I graduated from Duke Divinity School. And at that time, in the early 2000s, Duke was one of the divinity schools that had a partnership with the British Methodist Church to help place United Methodist pastors in Methodist churches in the UK for a year or 5 years. And so when I signed the contract and made the commitment, I wasn't sure, honestly, if I could be away from my sister for 5 years, living in a totally different country. It was my first time living outside of the US, and I was just really nervous about leaving home, and specifically my sister. But in another kind of my own spiritual journey way, when I came back to South Carolina after being at Duke and Divinity School, I had changed so much as far as my perspective, some of my theological understandings, and the questions that I was wrestling with. And I felt myself constantly coming up in tension with life back at a place that was home for me. And I struggled a lot that first year out of seminary. And I'll never forget being on my knees in my apartment. And I was playing my guitar in my apartment. And then all of a sudden it turned into like a wailing and deep cry, asking for some kind of liberation from where I was. I just was crying out to God for some opening and some for me to leave. And so it still makes me tear up just thinking about that moment for me, and longing and hope for something different where I could fully show up as myself and still sit with the questions. I didn't want to run from the questions, but I really wanted to something different.
Mm-hmm. So you have to tell me if this is too personal a question, but one was, so when you're, I've been in that spot when you're pleading to be freed from something, it usually means you're around the corner from being freed to something, right? Like you're finding your way and want to know what's of God in some way, looking back. So one, I'm curious, like what was happening, but also that experience was part of your artistic formation as well. So tell us what was going on in Leeds.
Yeah, so received the invitation during that time of pleading and prayers to join very late on the British Methodist Church and part of this program. And I asked to be in a city. I was like, I'll go, but if I could be in a city. And they offered Leeds. And I was like, I've never heard of it, but I'm excited to go. And so much life found me there. I was constantly, they called me the singing reverend because I took my guitar every place I went. My music and my love for music grew. But especially visually, I took a camera with me and I photographed the landscape. The people, the moments and experience in ways that I hadn't experienced photography before, and began a real interest in that mode of creative expression. And my time in Leeds, the pace of life, the community, just the newness of it all, and curiosity of it all provided space for that.
Can I ask, what did you, because I know Azariah was still a youth, which is why Leeds wasn't famous yet. But I mean, was it the light, the people, the architecture, just difference from home? What was it?
Yeah, I think it was the difference from home. I think it was when I was in seminary, I was taught that when we move into a new place, we are to love it, do the work of falling in love with the place, with the people, before we begin to even think about offering any insight of change or possibility for a place. And so when I was going over, I knew that I wanted to quickly, because I only had a year, and not necessarily with the hope of offering any advice for change or insight, or that I thought I had any kind of wisdom or perspective to offer, but knowing like I wanted to fall in love. And so for me, part of following in love is to immerse myself in the culture and just the daily rhythms and fabrics of the place, and to seek to see it anew, and to really see it. And the camera provided a way for me to document that falling in love experience in a way that I don't draw, that's not a practice that I lean into. And at that time I wasn't painting, and songwriting, it just didn't seem like the right medium. I really wanted to be able to capture moments and share it with the people I loved at home. So, yeah.
That's brilliant. That's really wonderful to hear that sense of sight and second sight with the camera. I'm curious about when you met other black and brown people in Leeds, what was that like? Because, as a black person from Leeds, the real black people were African Americans because of the movies. And so I remember if I met a black person who had a strong accent from, say, Northern Ireland or Scotland, it would always throw me. So what was it like, your experience of meeting black people in Leeds? People with that sense of diaspora, what was it like for you? Was that interesting? Was that jarring? Was that curious?
Yeah, no, it was brilliant, because I was immersed in white Leeds culture and community with the churches. And so it's unfortunate, I did not have an immersion in the black Leeds, the culture of blackness in Leeds. I had a member from her family was from Jamaica, but she grew up in London. And every time she would speak, I would just be like, oh, my heart would be so warm. Just the difference of the voice and the kind of unexpected nature of it, to come out of this black body, black beautiful body. And then I formed a relationship with two gentlemen from Nigeria, who had come to England to be missionaries, British, in the church, and I loved it so much. But we would spend, we formed a friendship and would meet towards like the middle of my journey once a week to just be in prayer together. And I remembered just being in awe of just this deep, deep, just spiritual hope, that, I don't know, my sister says, like, if you want to learn to pray, like, just spend some time in Africa. She wrote a book about praying with Africa, and she traveled the countries, and it was like my first time really experiencing that, that just felt familiar in a way of like my early formative years in the black church of the South. In the second grade, my dad became the first cross-racial appointment in South Carolina. And so I was in white churches from the second grade on. And this is a different kind of encounter with spirituality in the spaces. And so being with my friends in Leeds and praying with them felt like strangely like home in the midst of this place that was becoming home. So, it was fun.
That's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Now, I wonder, you spoke about second grade. I'm curious, your mini-me version, what was her encounter with art and artistry and artistic expression within the world?
You know, the word is that I came out of my mom's belly dancing and singing, you know, that I was singing to Michael Jackson and dancing on the Pizza Hut tables of Atlanta while my dad was in seminary. But music, especially, and dance, my mom's an artist, my dad's a pastor. And in our home, they really cultivated a space for creative expression and curiosity. They had us, if we voiced wanting to learn how to play the violin, they would figure out a way financially and logistically to make that happen. You know, they really wanted to ground us, you know, just kind of nurture that part of ourselves. And so grew up singing and dancing, theater, all of those things. You know, visual arts was something like painting. We would draw, you know, my sister, we would imagine new worlds. So the imagination and creativity was definitely a part of our household. And I loved at that early years to draw and to color. I loved color. And then in the seventh grade, I got a C in art class. And I was an A student, you know, maybe a B here and there. So I was very upset. And the little seventh grade me, who knew she was an artist, challenged the teacher and was told basically that I deserved the grade that I received. And the bubble was popped. And in my mind, you know, like I said, in the seventh grade, we had transitioned into a predominantly white culture all around, you know, and growing my early years, I was formed in the Black community and the Black experience. And, you know, you begin to insecurities formed really early for me. I felt that I needed to be perfect, to belong, to be an exceptional, maybe not perfect, but an exceptional Black girl, to have a place of belonging and to, in many ways, just to survive some of, now that I have the language, some of the violence and microaggressions that I encountered. So in the seventh grade, when my teacher told me this was not something I was exceptional at, I was like, oh, okay, well, I'll let it go. And I will focus my energy on those things that I am exceptional at and that I really do love. And so music still stayed a part of my life, but the visual, I just kind of let it go.
Wow. And when you say seventh grade, just for the British listeners, is that sort of 11, 12 years old? Is that around that?
I was about 12, 13. Yeah, 12.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So jarring even for me to remember the influence of teachers and what teachers tell you you can and cannot do. So much of my experience was not being who the teacher expected and trying very hard to do that. So here in Atlanta, I'm not in Atlanta right now, Stacey Abrams has kind of brought to the fore the Methodist Church and the Black Methodist Church and how she talks about, she's running for governor, right? And how she talks about her early formation, what it means to be community and what it means to be good citizens together. And she regularly references the fact that both of her parents were Methodist ministers. So Black Methodists that come out of the Black Methodist Church but then find themselves in these, again, cross-racial appointments in churches. And so it's really interesting to hear those stories, and I feel like I've heard similar ones from you. So I'm curious about how that, one, were your parents able to work on that with you, or was it so intense for them to kind of negotiate these spaces that everyone was kind of making their own way? Like, it was almost like an immigration experience, right? And then how did that influence your faith formation?
My parents were keenly aware, as much as they could be, because he was a pioneer, right? He was the first cross-racial appointment in South Carolina since Reconstruction, is how they like to say it, within the Methodist Church. And my dad articulates even to this day this awareness and conversation that my parents had about them not wanting us to lose the sense of self. My parents, they were actively involved in the civil rights. They created spaces. My mom was a dance teacher and created space within the church fellowship hall for young Black bodies to dance, to learn how to dance, to take up space and be in our bodies and to see it as good, you know? So they very much wanted my sister and I to hold on to that, and in some ways, like sacred love of ourselves and ways we saw ourselves. But like you said, we were all kind of navigating and negotiating this new space that there was no way we could fully be prepared for for what we would encounter, as well as just like not only moments of that of pain, that's very real, but also like just moments of real beauty and love that came in probably some of the places where we didn't expect it to show up, and support and community. I think my black church experience and that early foundation taught me so much about being an artist, about my voice. It taught me how to sing and love music. Even today in my practice, I refer to my experience, formative experience in the church, early years as like the call and the response, how that works itself out in some of the practices, even in my studio, and how I do collage work. It gave me a deep grounding in music and songs that I've pulled upon in some of my deepest moments of despair and pain, as well as the words that helped me celebrate the joy that I have that the world didn't give to me and this world can't take away, you know. And so I pull on a lot of those things. Spiritually, though, I just kept on trucking. I loved God, and I think that has still remained for me. Even throughout my whole journey, where there have been moments where I've been really disillusioned with the church and frustrated with the church, disappointed in the church, and then also surprised by it. But my draw towards this divine, creative, loving force in the world and wanting to be close to it, to understand it, and for it to fully embody me and be a part of my life has never changed. And yeah, and so there are very specifics to church culture, as you all kind of know, when it comes to how we live out our faiths and worship experiences. And, you know, and that changed a bit, was a little bit to adjust to, and some questions of self-identity, you know, the things that I preferred, the ways I expressed myself, you know, just a lot of, yeah, I don't know. It was an interesting journey that I'm still kind of unpacking now that I'm back home. In many ways, it feels very tender still for me. One of my professors in div school, I had a kind of a, you know, a moment of crisis in school where we were studying the fallacy of race and the ways the church can speak to and has participated in some of the systematic racism that exists today. And I was just telling him about my journey, and he looked at me and said, you know, you have lived a biracial existence in this world, being fully in a black body, but your experience has made, has been one of a almost like biracial existence. And no one had given me that language or that lens in which to kind of read my experience before. And I'm still, this was like in 2003, and I'm still kind of trying to unpack all of the dynamics of what that means and who I am today. Yeah.
You've spoken about home being a place where you can show up is, you know, when you say show up, it makes me think of an exhibit, you know, that you can be seen fully as a piece of art. And I'm curious, in some of your transition, what were some of the ways that you felt you weren't able to show up? You know, where actually you were inhibited. There was the music was playing, but you weren't allowed to dance. There was, you know, someone picked up a guitar, but you weren't allowed to sing. I'm curious about those moments and how art provided a way through for you.
My experience is unique in the sense that I come from a household. So my nuclear family was so key to my survival in many ways. That home for me, in the sense that my parents always taught us that we had a voice, we had gifts. They affirmed that creative parts of ourselves as well as our intellectual capabilities and fought hard for us to be seen. I know, like even thinking about some of my struggles in the educational system during some of the transitional moves and my parents having to combat some prejudices specifically for me and fighting for the school system to see my intellect and beauty, you know, and all of those things and them showing up in that space. But they, you know, they taught us that I almost kind of naively thought that I could do anything that I wanted to do at any time, in any place, regardless of if I was Black or a woman, that I could just show up. And I found that as I lived this out, there were moments of true affirmation that often came from the church, to be honest. And I was very much affirmed and was a leader in the Methodist church there. But then there was this other thread, even some moments that would creep into my church experience where I was reminded quickly that being Black, being a woman, that I would face challenges, that I would face racism and sexism in ways that I began to shrink, you know, in some spaces. I would literally shrink. And when before that move, I was a very, I loved the stage. I loved being up front. I found a lot of life there in community and with people. And I slowly began to see myself become this introvert that did not like to be up front unless I knew it was safe. Because I combated both, you know, not being invited to even like birthday parties, you know, sleepovers in the homes of kids that I would worship with on Sunday and also go to school throughout the week. And, you know, kids tell what their parents don't want you to hear. And I would know it was because I was a Black girl. You know, you go into middle school and kids that you worship with on Sunday are having parties in their homes and you're not invited, though y'all all share the same friends at school, and you hear it's because, you know, parents were concerned that you wouldn't have anybody to dance with. You know, like these little small moments did make me question at times the truth of these things that we were saying on Sunday that we claimed that we would sing about and that was a part of us. But then in the everyday living outside of those Sunday mornings or Wednesday night fellowships, how was it being lived out? So at a young age, I began to kind of see the dissonance and the questions, yeah.
Anisa, I was reading about your gallery space in Richmond, and I don't know if this was, I mean, I remember seeing images of your gallery space in Houston, which was so unique, I thought. I'd not seen anything quite like that. I thought that was amazing. In Richmond, you write about it being a gathering space as well as a place that you do work, if I read that correctly. And so it made me wonder, or just curious about how, as a person formed by both art and ministry, like how they inform each other, like the idea of gathering in a studio feels a little, I mean, I'm probably using the wrong term, but feels a little bit like deconstructed and kind of idealized gathering worship space, right? But how do those things work for you, or how do you articulate them?
Yeah, so I have a studio space. I'm fortunate to have a studio space in Houston and a studio space here in Richmond. And the space in Richmond is really new. And so I haven't, and it's smaller than my space in Houston. So it's a space that I have really only inhabited and haven't invited others in yet. The studio space in Houston, however, is very large. And when I got it, the first thing I did was commission one of my artist friends to build a table that was really big, that could sit 12 people. Because I knew in the space, I not only wanted to create, but I wanted to make space for other people to do the same. And, you know, even though my relationship with the church and has changed a bit and evolved, I would say my theology as I age and experience life has evolved, there are still certain symbols and practices that I have hold on to and continue to shape my imagination. And so the communion table is one, that sacrament of communion. And I remember as a child loving it and being challenged by it and wishing that people would listen to the words that we were saying and that it could, that we could actually like extend it beyond our church doors, because I thought it was so powerful. In the Methodist Church, we talk about this table where everyone is welcome, where everyone can come and receive food, you know, and that you didn't have to, there was no like things you had, boxes you had to check off in order to come up, but that we all came wanting and needing the same things. And so I wanted to create a table in my studio where people could fully show up as themselves and experience the life, the joy, the healing, the play, the beauty that I experienced through art at the table. And so I would hold workshops, community workshops in there. And then eventually I partnered with a local church that's now Holy Family Episcopal Church in Houston, Texas, to do art, to help with the flourishing of the arts in our city, was the mission of the church. And we partnered to host workshops in my studio where money didn't become a barrier. People could donate if they had it, but we offered these free art workshops that were similar to the ones that I was having people pay for, you know, so there were quality art spaces for people truly just to tap into that creative well that is within all of us and experience and taste the goodness of putting paint on paper and collage and playing with encaustics, you know, so all of these things. And the church partnered with me to do that. And then I partnered with them to lead an artist collective of artists every year. It's a new collective every year. 8 to 12 people who practice various mediums in our city. We've had, you know, ceramic artists, photographers, poets, a barber. I think expansively about what art can be in this world and creative expression. And so inviting these people to journey together for a year intimately, meeting once a month. And then at the end, we have a big collective show to celebrate. And it's so cool. I love this part of our partnership because it's no doubt, you know, artists, we always, I think, always struggle with a bit of imposter syndrome. That's just kind of real for us, part of the fabric. But it's always interesting to me how we show up at this table and so many people at the table are like, I'm here because X, Y, Z, but I don't really consider myself an artist. And then at that end of the journey together, them being more comfortable, at least claiming that identity, or at least claiming the identity of creative, or wanting to further explore that. And so that part of our relationship, partnership has been so life-giving for me, and continue to do that even from a distance. I go back once a month if I can to be with the collective members and on that journey, even though we're split cities now. And then I make art. Recently, they have built a new building that has a gallery, and they wanted to honor our partnership. We've been in partnership since 2016 by naming it after me, which is so, I still can't find the words to express what that means to me. But yeah, so there's a gallery space that will host the work of local Houston-based artists. And it's a space that is not regulated. Their art is not regulated. We don't say it has to have any particular aim or subject matter, but where we hope that the artists who exhibit their work and entrust us with their work feel like they can fully show up.
So I can't remember this person's name right now, but in the early 1900s, the rector of St. Mark's in the Bowery, which is where I was a few jobs ago, in the East Village in New York, so the kind of the great bustle of the arts in the East Village in New York, said that that art would be the way Americans access spirituality in the 20th century. And so then opened that space up to dance and sculpture and poetry and visual art. And it seems to me that's what you're describing, and also that, but with a connection made more concretely than most of us do in how we both make or engage art, then it's the 21st century. But what the conversation makes me think of is what seems to me what you're actually doing is where, like, Azariah and I try in church to, you're eventually trying to get people there in, frankly, quite a convoluted way through Jesus, you know, and years of coming up to that altar and we'll see if we could actually get you to access your maker creative soul self, right? Through this almost disguised path, right? That we're afraid to say directly the things that you're offering in these workshops to bring your full self. So one, I'm curious about, am I misreading that, or is that actually what you're doing? And then two, that said, how would you describe your spirituality today?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you are misreading it at all. I do try to curate and cultivate these spaces that allow room for deep, deep spiritual kind of nurturing and tending. Though, like I said, it's truly like technique, and we're engaging poetry, and I'm guiding them through steps of making and creating something. So it's not, I don't want it to sound like it's not like a Sunday school class of some sort, right? It is definitely like art workshops experiences, but like I bring in Lectio Divina and I just adapt it to poetry in a way that opens people up. You know, I think there are practices of our faith tradition that definitely can be translated and used to hold space for a more expansive experience, I guess, if that says, or where people may be, yeah. So an expansive experience of spirituality and possibility. And so I want to provide that for people through the arts. My spirituality, gosh, man, all of the things of my life, I just was so immersed in it. Like all of the traditions and the teachings and the experiences are just in me, right? And it's just a part of me. I kind of nurture that part of myself through staying tapped into the community, community and relationships with people. I have daily rituals of being with the poets mostly is where I spend a lot of my centering time with language these days. And music is still very much a part of that too. And I practice Lectio with just poets instead of scripture these days. And I move through the world, just hoping and looking and expecting to encounter the divine, to encounter beauty, to encounter something that will make me curious or make me further want to dive into the questions of purpose and what it means to be a human in this world. And as an artist, as James Baldwin's essay, The Creative Process, talks about, he said the role of an artist is to dive into that deep darkness that is within us, like to these wilderness places. He doesn't say darkness, the wilderness places within us, so that then we can do that work, internal work, and then participate in helping to make this world a more human dwelling place.
It's gorgeous to hear these. I wonder if there might be something you could share with us. I don't know if there's a verse of a song. Maybe there's a few lines of a poem that you wouldn't mind sharing.
Yeah, you know, well, something of you. I wish I knew this collection well enough to read one of her works. I just got this, and it's the poetry book that is the most
Pauline
acceptable
Murray.
To
yeah,
me.
Poem.
Yes,
yeah.
But I will share this one. During the pandemic, I was listening to Poetry Unbound with Padraig O Tuama, and he read a poem by Lucille Clifton. And she has been my companion since 2020. And if someone were to ask me to paint a self-portrait with words, I would read this poem. Won't you celebrate with me what I have shaped into a kind of life? I had no model, born in Babylon, both non-white and woman. What did I see to be except myself? I made it up here on this bridge between starshine and clay. My one hand holding tight, my other hand. Come celebrate with me that every day something has tried to kill me and has failed.
Wow, that's so gorgeous, thank you. And the word bridge was in there as well. And you have created a bridge from, you know, all the way from where you are to my boyhood home in Leeds. And my childhood home is a little bit more restored after encountering you. So thank you so much.
Oh, that's beautiful. Lanicia, thank you so much for being in conversation with us. So good to see your face for an hour on that screen. Thank you. I hope to see you soon in person.
Me too. Thank
Say
you.
Say goodbye, Azariah.
Bye-bye, Azariah. Bye-bye. Bye-bye, everybody. I was just told to say bye-bye, Azariah. yes, goodbye. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Lanicia Rouse Tinsley was talking to Winnie Varghese and Azariah France Williams. Randolph Matthews composed the music. Grace is produced by me, Rosie Dawson, and is a Heart Edge production. You can find more conversations about God and race by going to heartedge.org, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Please subscribe, listen, review, and share Grace with your friends.